old friends, Jim Scherzinger.
Yeah, I can do this, but...
We're expecting the governor to be dropping in for some testimony on House Bill 3942, but before he does, let's go ahead and get started and invite Representative Morgan and her entourage to come forward, and we will open a work session on House Bill 2670. Oh, I thought Bill was heading out the door. I thought you just lost your consensus. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Susan Morgan. I'm state representative of District 46, which contains the Myrtle Creek Golf Course that we're here to discuss with you today. The last time we came to talk to you, we had the draft of a bill to give property tax exemption to the golf course, which met with some problems with different groups. You very graciously allowed us to form a work group, and we've worked out a compromise and essentially gotten set the bill. And we're back here with the compromise. And what I'd like to do is allow Mr. Joe Wolf, who is the city administrator for the city of Myrtle Creek, to give you some of the history and the background on why we need to do this and what the golf course means to Myrtle Creek.
Okay, please.
For the record, I'm Joe Wolf, city administrator in the city of Myrtle Creek. Back in about 95, 96, the city of Myrtle Creek was looking at ways to diversify its economic base. The Timber Initiative came along and some funding was made available. The city was also facing problems with our sewage effluent because of the flows and the water quality limits on Myrtle Creek and on the South Umpqua River. We were able to put together, and again, keep in mind, I am an after the fact, wasn't there at the time that this was all started. There was a package put together using grants, loans from the state, from the Forest Service, and the land was purchased to be an effluent disposal site, which is the idea was to take the water from the sewer treatment plant, use it for irrigation purposes, and take it out of the river during the times of low flow, high temperature, and concern from the environmental side. The land was purchased by the city. Consequently, the city created a nonprofit corporation, the Myrtle Creek Building Authority, which sold bonds to construct the golf course. And again, the idea being that the city would not be responsible for the debt of the building authority. The building authority leased the land from the city. The lease calls it at the end of 25 years, when bonds are paid off and they're debt-free. The city would then own the golf course free and clear and operated in such a manner that it would become tax-exempt at that point. The building authority did receive tax statements in 97. They paid the 97-98 taxes under protest. We've tried to appeal with the county assessors. Again, it's a nonprofit corporation. The city is a corporate entity, and the land belongs to the city. We have been unable to get the tax exempt status. The building authority is currently delinquent. They have not paid their 98, 99, 99, 2000, 2000, 2001 taxes. And what we're hoping here is that we can get them put into a situation where they are a tax exempt or recognized as tax exempt by the assessor's office. If I can expand just a little bit, the golf course, again, I think it has done what it was intended to do as far as the tourism recreation aspect for the local community. It holds a number of charitable golf tournaments in the area. Three high schools, Glide, Umpqua, and Douglas, use that for their home course. We've seen more housing starts in the last 4 years than they had in the previous 10 years. So it is doing the things, and I think attracting people to the community and being an economic boon, and obviously we would like to see it if we could put them on a little better footing.
The golf course is an important economic development tool to the community. It's the kind of situation where everyone that comes to town to play the course drives right down the main street of town to get to the golf course, and so it's a boost to the little main street small businesses that exist there. You've got handed out to you a package of letters from the local jurisdictions that will be losing the tax revenue if the golf course is granted a tax-exempt status. And you have before you the -2 amendments to the bill that essentially don't allow, or they don't, give the golf course any reimbursement for taxes that have been paid, but they allow them to enter into a tax deferred status that will forgive the outstanding taxes and hold them in that tax deferred status until the bonds that were used to build the golf course are paid back. And, there also is a piece in there that says that the local entities or the local taxing districts need to agree to do this before it can come into being. And there also is a piece that limits the time when this whole thing has to functionally be completed. So with that, I will turn it over to my fine cohort over here to explain how we went through the process to come up with any amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. We sat down around a table. Is that the camera? Actually, this is a highly peculiar situation, and we handled it in a very narrow fashion with a local option element. And off on its own set of, as you notice in the Dash 2 amendments, its own statutes, so it can be printed in small type for the life of this particular peculiar kind of specific arrangement, and then disappear.
Okay. And what will be the life of this?
You can call it temporary, but it looks like it has about a 23-year life.
Okay. About the time the Michigan business activity tax is repealed.
What's that
like? Yeah, sorry. Okay, Lizbeth, I'm sorry, I stole your thunder in the rush to get Representative Morgan up here. Is there anything that you need to tell us?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'll just add that you do have a revenue impact, and after contacting the Douglas County Assessor, for 2001, the property taxes on the land is roughly $7,542. The unpaid property taxes for the previous three back years, $25,500. And so the total taxes that would come off, that would be reduced and waived in the 2002-03 would be $40,886.
And again, that's on consent of the local tax.
That's right. And it's pretty unlikely that there would be any other property tax exemptions granted for golf courses in the state, because basically there are a lot of very specific details that have to be met. You have to have the municipality that owns the golf course, and that then it leases it to this nonprofit corporation, and then you have to have all local governments that have to actually agree to grant the exemption, and then you have that narrow window of opportunity of only 6 months.
So this is the kind of bill you only see Myrtle Creek if you hold it up to the light and read it at just the right angle. Myrtle Creek on it. Okay, we are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
I believe we haven't moved the
Dash 2. No, we need to move the Dash 2.
Yeah, I would move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2670.
Senator Carlson moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2670. Is there any objection? Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2670 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Carlson moves House Bill 2670 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Fay. Aye.
Yeah.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. House Bill 2670, as amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Morgan, would you like to carry?
I would be very happy.
Constituent bill. Good. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Okay. Let's go into hearing on 3942. Paul, anything you want to bring us up to date on before we...
A couple of things, Mr. Chair, on House Bill 3942. The first is that, as often happens when I'm talking from a set of numbers, I realized that there was an error in your first recession scenario, and I've corrected that and given you a revised version. The effect of the revised version is to show that the scenario B, which is the severe recession scenario, under the new system would lead to a net fiscal position of about minus 690. I think I had about 590 in there. The calculation of the capital gains effect was not right. So that's been corrected, and that gives you a consistent set of numbers under what would be a plausible set of assumptions, I think. Certainly not a precise estimate, but to give you a sense of how the responsiveness of those two systems might affect the budget under a mild recession or an average recession versus a severe recession. And scenario B would be certainly classified as a severe recession. So the other thing, Mr. Chair, is I've just made a copy out of the latest survey of current business on consumption patterns, and there are some very long-term consumption patterns. Remember, Tony Ruffalo described this last Friday. But just to show you one of the issues that's happened with the retail sales tax, the service base, which is not typically taxed in a retail sales tax, has gone from 40% of consumer expenditures in 1959 to 58% in the year 2000. So the sales tax states are seeing this gradual erosion of their base relative to income as services increase. And the next chart, the next page there, just shows those numbers graphically. And again, you can see how the services component have consistently risen over time. And they've also, by the way, risen more for higher income individuals. So it does have a distributional effect as well.
Okay. Comments or questions? One thing else that I would mention, we've talked about the economic context in which we're discussing the House Bill 3942 and I think here is sort of the market context and the way this plays out in comparison with other possible scenarios such as the sales tax. I saw in the Mid-Valley Sunday an editorial that brings to mind another part of the context in which we're working here, and that's our own initiative process. And this is just an editorial that discusses a certain proposed initiative to grant property tax exemption for people over the age of 65, and with an estimate by our own legislative revenue office, I guess, that plan would cost $207 million a year in school taxes, $514 biennium, keeping in mind that senior tax relief for low-income seniors is part of the business activity tax plan, part of House Bill 3942. So there's that element of the context, too. The more we can do to address perceived inequities in the tax code, perhaps the better we will be able to head off pressure for relief in other less comprehensive and thoughtful ways. Governor Kitzhaber, welcome. Thank you for joining us today. I appreciate you coming down to speak to us on our House Bill 3942. I know you've had the overview on it. I'm just curious to get your comments on the record, sir.
Great. Thank you, Representative Federley. Members of the committee, for the record, John Kitzhaber, Governor of the State of Oregon. First, I really want to applaud you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the committee for the work that you're doing here and for taking on what has been a chronic and seemingly intractable issue in the state of Oregon. The history of this state is littered with the ruins of efforts to restructure the tax system, including my own in 1985, although I think we can claim a modest victory in the fact that we reduced the severity of our drubbing from 8-1 to 4-1, which is a significant percentage improvement.
In the old Oregon State football terms, they call that moral victory.
If you recall, Mr. Chairman, in 1998, I appointed a technical tax review committee that was chaired by U.S. Bank economist John Mitchell, and charged them with taking really a 20-year look at Oregon's tax structure, which in fact had been changed incrementally through actions of the Legislative Assembly and more dramatically through various voter initiatives. And in fact, they determined that the system had changed dramatically over the last 20 years without ever really looking at the impact of those changes on what we wanted our tax structure to reflect in terms of our economic and social policies, and particularly in terms of its stability. And the most significant finding was the increased reliance on the income tax as a result primarily of ballot measure 5, and as I'm sure you have recognized, the shift from having about maybe 30% on a good day state funding for our schools up to about 85%. So we have now put our educational endeavor, which constitutes 57% of the general fund, on a very unstable income tax source. Whatever else you can say about the property tax, it's a very stable source of revenue in a recession compared to the income tax. I then appointed a second group, a tax policy committee chaired by Ron Tempe, the CEO of Standard Insurance, and they made a couple of short-term and long-term recommendations, again, focusing primarily on the issue of stability. And I think it's important perhaps at this point to make a distinction between adequacy and stability. There are many people who call for tax reform. Some of them are interested primarily in getting more money. And the fact is that, to me, is not an issue of tax structure. It's an issue of tax adequacy. And there's nothing inadequate about the current tax system in terms of raising money. You crank up a couple percent increase in the personal income tax, and you generate a lot of money. That's an issue of really of more political will or voter support for increased revenue. I think what you're talking about here and what Ron Tempe's group was talking about was not increasing revenue generation, but changing the structure of the way we collected our taxes to try to make it more stable over the long term and to see whether the incentives and disincentives in the tax code reflected what we wanted to happen in our business community, the kinds of businesses we wanted to encourage and attract, and really the kind of policies that the state wanted to see enacted. They had, in terms of a short-term recommendation, they recommended the creation of a stability fund, and the long-term recommendation was to move towards a more balanced tax system that was less dependent on the income tax, and they further recommended exploring excise taxes and consumption taxes. And we actually tried to deal with the issue of the stability fund. Mr. Tempe and I, and actually Stan Bunn, tried to get a couple of measures on the ballot to deal with both adequacy and equity and stability. We dealt with the first two with ballot measure one, but because of the need to generate resources for defeating ballot measure 91, much of which came from the business committee, we were unable to put a stability fund on the ballot, so that's unfinished business. In terms of the long-term recommendations, they reviewed 12 major options, and in the category of major system restructure, they came very close to what you have here in House Bill 3942. It wasn't pursued for a number of reasons. One, we had an extraordinarily robust economy, and people really didn't believe that we were going to ever see a downturn. There was no tax incident study at the time to really guide that debate. And there wasn't a live bill in front of the legislature to bring people to the table and talk about the details. I think that given the current circumstances with an economy that's certainly flattening out, if not slipping down a bit, I think the whole question of long-term stability of our tax structure becomes very, very timely. And I think that what you have here in 3942 is a well-reasoned alternative to the existing tax system that addresses many of the concerns and needs that were identified by Ron Tempe's committee. It clearly provides a much more stable revenue system for the state. It addresses, I think, many of the concerns of small businesses through your $100,000 filing threshold for gross receipts. You do reduce personal income taxes. You have a refundable income tax credit for dealing with issues of regressivity. Obviously, a lot of questions remain how this impacts exporters, for example, and a whole host of other questions. But you have a vehicle and a committee with the experience, I think, to address those things thoughtfully and to see where you can take this. You know, the transition from one tax system to the other one is always very difficult, and we haven't ever had major tax restructuring in Oregon that has come out of the legislature. It's always come through the initiative process, which is a very blunt instrument for making these kinds of choices. And I would simply urge, I would encourage you and urge members of the business community and the labor and who else ever has an interest in tax restructuring to take this very seriously and to view this as a window of opportunity to engage in a meaningful discussion on something that really does need to be done. And I think when you look at it, at a new tax system, people tend to compare the new tax structure with a theoretical ideal. And, of course, you always fall short. instead of comparing the new tax structure with the existing tax structure. And I think it's important to apply the same standards of judgment to the business activities tax that you would apply to the existing tax system, because it would probably be very difficult today to pass a bill through the legislature or through the voters that would enact the current tax system. So you have an opportunity here, I think, and I, again, applaud all of you for taking this on and would hope that you can move this forward.
Thank you very much. Questions for the governor? Representative Wood, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Governor, in looking at this package and the various elements of this package, are you comfortable with the direction in which it goes in terms of all of its elements? I mean, it has a capital gains reduction, it eliminates the corporate income tax, it provides some low-income working family tax relief. There's several elements to this package. Do you think all of these elements make sense and fit together intelligently in your judgment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I guess the short answer is yes. I think you really have included the key elements necessary to be a part of a comprehensive package. Now, obviously, the devil's in the details, but I do think that you have on the table all the pieces that are necessary. And I think what is needed now is a thoughtful discussion of the impact and the trade-offs that these have on the various impacted constituencies.
I appreciate your comments about the issue of the difference between the issues of adequacy and stability, and something we try to underscore here on a regular basis, that in fact, This is designed not to increase or to reduce the size of revenue, the amount of revenues coming in, but basically stabilize so that we can budget and develop programs and make commitments to services on a long-term basis for some rational basis based on a tax system that's predictable. And to me, that's critical.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? The governor, I want to get a quick evaluation here of his testimony. Bat meter. A favorable evaluation, maybe. Yeah.
I've got a small prehistoric creature we call Vetosaurus Rex.
I want to say I felt it, but. Thank you for coming down. We appreciate your time.
Not this session.
Yet.
Well, Tony Van Vliet has joined us. Speaking of experience on the Revenue Committee, Tony, you probably have more terms than all of us put together just about, aren't you, on the Revenue Committee. Welcome you and appreciate you coming down to testify today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tony Van Vliet from Corvallis and former legislator, and I thought the governor really did a marvelous job of explaining the real need for stability here, but I thought I might take you back a little bit on a few things, and that is, I think, one of the reasons that the legislature has not put forward its own plan directly and passed it into legislation is because just conventional wisdom has said in the past that if you did pass a bill that normally the public would probably refer it in some ways. So it doesn't mean the legislature hasn't come up with some pretty good tax plans, because there has been some very excellent ones that the legislature has dealt with, and at least from the time that I was in, starting in 1975. And as experience from the standpoint of having served on revenue for two sessions before going on ways and means for the next 16 and a half years, I thought I'd bring you a little bit of perspective from the budgeting standpoint and why this is a measure that basically is long a need. Having been through the wars of the sales tax, in fact, the bill of 1981, which was first drafted, House Bill 2001, which seemed like an appropriate number at that time, became also almost identical legislation in 1983, almost identical legislation in 1985, and was the governor's probably the basis and the genesis of the other tax measures that went out. And as you know, that there is a very hardcore anti-sales tax group in the state of Oregon, some of which were legislators at the time, and have always given that particular measure a very tough show as when you take it out to the public. Well, I'm not an expert in VAT or BAT taxes, but I would like to say that I'm a strong advocate for what you're doing in this particular measure because of its need for the balancing feature. And that is that a long time ago when we were studying the sales tax issue, and this is almost identical from the standpoint of what you need to balance that income tax out with, is you need a tax that is going up at the same time that the other one may be going down. We call it exponential smoothing of the curve, and it happens that these taxes seem to lag behind each other as they're on the ups and downs, and you get a more stable situation, which you desperately need in budgeting. And so here you stand with, in 1979, we were in the exact place that you were a little while ago, looking at a sensational economy. And at the tail of 1979, we hit the wall. And the unexpected happened, and the budget went down, and it went down by almost 25%. We were dealing with $2.3 billion general fund and having to look forward to cutting between anywhere between $500 and $600 million out of that budget. Now, that doesn't – it gives Ways and Means chairs heartburn to deal with an issue like that, and certainly for the next seven special sessions, we dealt with the issue of trying to balance those budgets out. Now, I'm hoping that you don't, certainly at this time with the shortfalls that you're experiencing based on a over $11 billion budget, you're not experiencing a 25% revenue shortfall. Let's hope that you do not experience that, because that is a disaster. But at any rate, trying to find that much money out of a very small general fund was an enormous task. We robbed every tin can possible, and some people accused us of maybe robbing a little too hard when we took the safe funds, which some of us were drastically against, but at any rate, it was used as a balancing effort. So we cut a little over $300 million directly out of budgets, and we raised a surtax to make sure that we would still keep supporting schools and the essential line of services in place. The key question a legislature always has to face, I think, is how you weather these storms and how you look at your responsibilities as a government, and what are those responsibilities as a government that needs to be met. That is probably the toughest question, and Governor Kitzhaber did not talk about the fact that in the summer of 1992, he did form a committee of legislators along with House Speaker Campbell that were to sit down and actually figure out what government should spend their funds on. It was an enormous task, and unfortunately it ended in 93 and with no real definite conclusions other than the fact that there was a strong feeling that we should be paying for education, we should be paying for health service, we should be paying for roads, we should be paying for prisons, and we should be paying for many of the assistance programs we were in. And we were just beginning to get a handle on how much of that we should really be doing as both a society and a legislature looking at state government. I can tell you that Measure 5 and Measure 50 knocked us in the head from the standpoint that all of a sudden what could have been probably dealt with and given us a little bit more breathing time as far as dealing with the taxation issue, what it did is switch immediately to the fact that we were hit with having to fund schools, and all of a sudden, in the 1991 session, which was the first session that we put ballot measure 5 into effect, and I was co-chair of Ways and Means at that time, we were still able to keep education afloat, and we were able at that time to start to pay for the SIM and CAM program in education, which consequently were not paid for in subsequent sessions. Much of your problem in education today stems to the fact that that was never fully funded by legislatures after that, and consequently is getting a lot of the criticism why our educational system is in tough shape. So that is the consequence, what happens with dramatic shifts in the Ways and Means. Ways and Means is faced with the question of how do you face these budgets, how do you make these cuts and still be responsible to the people of the state of Oregon? Few people know that in 1991, $90 million of maintenance on state buildings was left on the table. Few people know that there was a tremendous number of human services that were cut that were never replaced. Same ones, some of the ones that you're looking at, additional ones today, of cutting out some of those services.
We had just, in the previous section, tried to get back in 1987-1989 legislatures, tried to look at the first time we started to see fresh air in the budget of coming back and dealing with some of the things such as special education. With all of a sudden the rise of Alzheimer's, and people never really recognized that 40-year-olds and 30-year-olds got Alzheimer's, and we were seeing families devastated who had no back funding at all come in and come to the Ways and Means Committee and Human Resources and need to have that kind of funding help. We were able to start. That was dropped later on. I don't know where that program is today. I don't know where the programs are for some of the children programs. I don't know where some of the rehabilitation programs in the prisons are today. But I can venture to say that during that period from 1981 through the period of, we'll say, 91, that crucial period, many of those agencies did not get back to the levels they were. You were not even at state police levels or not back at 1975 levels right today. So the fact that you face is, as you try to fix the system, you have to look at the fact that you're going to try not to increase revenue, but you're still going to try to maintain a balanced system of services with a gain of over a million of people in the state of Oregon, which is a 33% increase since 1975. So we not only have a million more people to worry about, we have a system that is basically out of kilter and cannot cope with it. You have a smaller property tax system, which is a weak second leg, an inefficient and basically probably unfair income tax system, and you have no third leg bolstering the system up that can carry you through any other rough times. So that is what you have to look at, and that's why I think you're doing a very courageous thing in approaching that particular side of the fence. Now, we can keep solving problems by putting Band-Aids over some of these programs, but I can tell you that they'll continue bleeding as your population increases, and most of the problems that were on the radar screen in 1975 through 1991, some of them have disappeared, and you've got new ones now. Drug programs were never even on the radar screen back in the 70s. And many of the programs that you're looking at now as really serious problems that are being faced with in society are all of a sudden beginning to be very costly ones to deal with and try to solve. So I can say that if you can develop any kind of tax, in fact, anything that is a leveling and still being fair, and I think that this is a fair tax, you will be doing the state quite a service. I'll go one step further and hope that someday we could wean ourselves off the lottery fund, which I think is not supposed to be basically and never was supposed to be used as a general fund system. It was supposed to be used for capital expenditure improvement when it was originally voted on. And that would maybe help you take care of some of the seismic problems that are coming along, but you can't do that because you're using that in general fund. So right now, I don't see how you can probably eliminate that particular one right at this moment with what you're facing. I'll stop there and be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Tony, questions? Yes, Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Recognizing the intertwining of the Ways and Means process and the revenue process, there are some who talk about, and the governor talked about adequacy of revenues, and I know that I'm sitting on the Human Services Ways and Means Subcommittee this time, and as is Representative Bates, and we're looking at drastic cuts in a number of different human resources programs. And so my question is that there's sort of this, what would you say, not calling it, I guess, sort of common, I don't think of the word to describe it. Anyway, there's sort of, maybe I'll just be really blunt, that sort of a mythology out there that somehow we should go to a zero-based budgeting approach because there's a bloatedness in government. And you talked about what happened in the 80s and the reductions that agencies took during the 80s. And I'm wondering if you would just comment on whether you believe, I mean, some of the contradictory opinions that I've heard on that idea is that in the 80s, agencies were cut back so very far, and you were mentioning that with state police and others, that they really, in the 90s, didn't have a chance even to recover, let alone become so bloated that we're seeing excess in terms of government. So can you just comment generally on how that process happened in the 80s and whether
you believe that a zero-based budgeting approach is actually necessary now for us to get down and figure out if government is indeed bloated or not.
Zero-based budgeting has been talked about as a concept ever since it was put into Georgia way long time back, and it was abandoned very quickly, mainly because of the very difficulty and the length of time it takes to do zero-based budgeting. And what you end up with is you end up still back where you are, looking at what needs to be the agency needs are and what they tell you their needs are. I guess the unfortunate thing is the lack of understanding of what continuous service level budgets are by the public, what roll-ups are, what are some of the things that are the cost of government, and what is really bloated and what is unbloated. I think the tragedy is two sessions on revenue were a great background for ways and means. The tragedy is some of you people may not be able to serve on it after your time is up and term limitations, which I think are bad news. But the two coming together are an excellent background for seeing on one side the revenue picture and the other side the expenditure picture. Of course, there will always be the comment that government is bloated. That's a great rhetoric for election time. It is super rhetoric for election time. But in truth and reality, if people were to delve into many of these budgets, yes, you will find some of the agencies that have got fat. One of the things about being longevity on Ways and Means is you find out who the good managers are and who the poor managers are over a period of time. You know what budgets really do need to be cut and which ones don't. But I venture to say you're having great difficulty today finding a lot of fat in these agencies. There's not much fat there after that period of time of the 80s that was left in. And I think that's probably one of the false assumptions that the public is making out there, is they still think the old rhetoric, government is a fat cat, not in the state of Oregon. We're not noted for being overly generous in our both our way we treat our overall budget. The fact is that we have one leg of that stool in taxation, which makes it people feel that they're being overly taxed. That's why any tax program that you're going to do has to have some equity dealt into that system and some relief in some of the other, so that you can basically have a balanced system. But people believe that they're overtaxed. People still believe they're overtaxed in property tax. They haven't sat down and figured out the two like pieces of property and under the same conditions are being taxed inequitably. But I don't think you're going to find on Ways and Means, for those of you that are serving there, especially in human resources, where I serve almost my entire time on human resources and education, which is 75% of the budget, you're going to find a heck of a lot of bloating. It's not there. You will find some, and you can whittle away a little here and there, and you can cut down salary increases and roll-ups. But eventually, you hurt the program enough that state getting good people to work for state government, which I believe we have, and have fought for against some very strong legislators who were convinced that state employees were not first-class citizens. I think you've got to have the very best in state government operating.
Anything else?
Just a quick question. You may not be able to answer this. Back when we made those big cuts, I remember the recession of 79, 80, 81, and what it did to Southern Oregon. What I wanted to know is, as a state legislator at that time, did you see real suffering in some sections of Oregon because of those cuts you had to make in that budget? You were on Health and Human Resources, I think.
Right.
You
No, we tried. Well, basically, we tried not to make a distinction between what was done east and west. In fact, we didn't look at it that way at all. When we were looking at, say, some of the medical programs, we were looking at the state overall. Health inspections. We know we had some counties that were doing their health inspections of restaurants themselves, and we were subsidizing. We had others where we had state employees doing health inspections. They both basically felt the same thing. We were making at that time about $300 million in transfer payments to cities and counties, which we tried to protect, because cities and counties basically today are being hurt by the fact that those transfer payments, a lot of them are no longer in existence. And those transfer payments pay for some of those subsequent services at the local level.
Mr. Chair. Is there anything else?
Tony, I just want to Seth, thank you for coming today. I appreciate your comments. I wish you were still in this chamber to help some of us new guys through the landmines.
Thank you.
We keep hearing that this plan is maybe too radical or too bold or too big to be done this session, and I totally disagree with that. And I know you were here when there were some bigger tax plans and proposals that went out during in the same legislative session. So I just wondered, given your political background, and what you think of that.
I think you got to go forward. You've got a good measure to work on, and you need to keep the momentum up and keep going. When you have a good tax measure, you need to move it forward as much as you can. You're going to have people still roadblocking along the way, but I think you're on the right track. There needs to be a balanced element, and this is as good a tax as you could probably figure out to do it, and doesn't have a lot of the snakes hanging on to it like the sales tax does.
Oh, we found a few.
You always have snapping turtles that come up as paper.
That was Jack Monroe that brought us that, snapping turtles on Wednesday. Well, you know, it's interesting, honey, you mentioned the impact of, let's say, ballot measure 5, how Senate President Kitzhaber and Speaker Campbell had started this process of making this careful evaluation about what government ought to be spending on and what the services should be, I assume, with some plan in mind, ultimately, to use that information for budget purposes,
right,
for revenue purposes. But then in the middle of that process, out of the initiative, comes ballot measure 5, and you're right, that scattered all those plans, and all of a sudden it became a matter of reorienting the reality of the next session to ballot measure 5, and I think that probably dealt a blow to some of that long-term planning that might have gotten started. And I guess it's more of a comment than a question, but in respect to what we hear that this is good, but let's study it, let's think about this for a long time, my concern about that is, number one, we've got some changes in the economy that are coming that may make it more difficult for us to do this in 2 years or 4 years' time. And, as I referred to earlier in my comments, we've got initiative proposals out there that themselves could be more disruptive than anything that we're planning, and disruptive in a negative way. I guess just appreciate your comment on that based on your history.
Well, the problem of trying to get people interested in what you're working on unfortunately comes at a time when recessions or at least their economic downturns take place. It should be a time when the market is up and everything is looking good that we look at tax reform. Unfortunately, we are crisis-oriented, so we deal with it when the market goes down, and we think that's the time to do that. And consequently, that then has a lot of the folks who basically are going to be hurt by the recessionary aspect of it, not very enthusiastic about any tax changes. However, I don't think you can get away from that. When in 1991, when we finished that session, it was in the summer of 91, and I think or 92 that we dealt with this, trying to figure out what government should be paying for, because we saw that, one, we were going to have a problem really paying for everything people would like to have. And so you have to really come down with the philosophical stance is, you know, at the same time you're looking at this, you have to more or less be thinking about what are the legitimate responsibilities of state government to its citizens of the state of Oregon. What things should we be doing? Where should we be helping? And how should we keep a cushion to make sure that we don't slip off again? And that's a hard thing to give a legislature to do. But I commend you for trying.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Was that
one more little question?
Yes, sure.
Any words of advice to us in terms of the pros and cons of referring a tax measure out to the voters as opposed to dealing with it in the body?
I think the whole thing stems a lot on how both the press picks up and supports you. They gave us strong support in the sales tax in 82-83. We found business was strong supporters, although there was a small group of business that basically was not. But there was, by and large, business was very supportive at that time of our measure. The strongest opposition, believe it or not, came from a small group of legislators who were part of a very strong anti-sales tax measure any time in history, one who happened to be in a position of power and another one who basically had gotten a lot of the troops out of the woodwork on an anti-sales tax measure. It does not take much to get a discouraging word, but at any rate, I think that if you can get very good information out to the people, Oregonians will understand what the situation is. And I think a lot of things about Oregonians is they have a very strong feeling about fairness. And if there is a fairness aspect to it, I think you have a good chance of selling.
Thank you, Tony, very much for coming in. That man up here to...
I check it.
Oh, he's got a good floor there.
Thanks very much.
You bet. Thank you. Tony, I guess I would just, as you're leaving, comment that with the advent of term limits and our loss of inherent institutional memory, it's nice to have it injected sometimes from the outside. So appreciate your comments, too, just on some of our predecessor bodies. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3942. See if we can knock out some... Yeah, actually, while we've got it, let's go to work session on 2477 and then 3080. Are those both EDs?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Ed is getting ready to tell us about the dash what amendments?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, dash one and dash two amendments were printed for House Bill 2477. As you'll recall, it creates an Oregon child credit, and in the base bill sets that credit equal to the federal child credit effective beginning 2002 tax year. Currently, the federal child credit is a maximum of $500 per child. We did have a public hearing on February 23rd on this bill, but no work. The dash one amendments were commissioned, I think, to try and reduce the revenue impact.
And I've got a dash two.
Yeah, right. That's correct, Mr. Chair. There's also a dash two. They're almost the same, except the dash twos limit the credit to $100 per taxpayer. In a tax year. The dash one amendment, the limitation is $100 for an individual in a tax year. So I guess technically the dash one amendments would allow a $200 credit, maximum $200 credit for a joint filer.
Mr. Chair, I don't
but
know
only
the
100.
You don't either. I just have a dash two.
I don't have a dash one.
You don't have dash one?
No.
I don't.
Do you know which one was Representative Close?
Dash one is the one that Representative Close requested.
Okay.
It allows a maximum $100 credit per individual in a tax year, which basically amounts to up to $200 credit for a joint filing.
Committee, this is the bill that... I think I spoke with you about on the floor individually. The Representative Close has requested that we pass out of this committee to Ways and Means. And I propose that the dash one amendments were the amendments that you wanted. I'm going to go ahead and put those in as part of moving the bill on to Ways and Means. Part of my commitment to her, and so I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2477. Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, we don't have the dash one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We only have the dash two.
Is it very long? Can you read it to us?
Would you rather have them in your file?
That'd be nice.
Well, I just like to know what they say.
Okay. Yeah. Well, why don't you read them and then we'll get them.
Okay, the dash one amendments, proposed amendments to House Bill 2477. In line six of the printed bill, delete, quote, the amount, unquote, and insert 20%.
Yep.
That's the same as the dash twos.
Okay.
And then in line 8, after the period, insert quotation marks, in no event may the credit allowed under this section exceed $100 for an individual in a tax year. So it uses the word individual instead of taxpayer.
Oh, I see.
That effectively doubles the credit for a joint filer.
Chairman, I wonder if that was Representative Close's intention, because under the federal law, it's $500 per, for qualifying taxpayers, it's $500 per qualifying child. The effect of this is to limit it to two children.
Ed, we got the dash twos on April 6th. I got the dash ones from Representative Close on, with a memo of March 30. Where did the dash twos come from?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I talked with LC about the dash one amendments and got the indication from them that the intention, Representative Close's intention originally was to limit it to $100 for a taxpayer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, then.
So I asked them to please do the dash two amendment post haste.
That would be the dash twos then.
That's correct.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little stunned by that. I mean, what if someone has 10 kids or 6 kids? I mean, we're limiting the credit kind of artificially here. That's certainly not the way the federal credit works. And I thought the effort here was to bring down the overall cost of the credit to the state in some proportionate manner. But that doesn't do that because it caps it essentially at two children.
But Ed, the dash one amendments do not cap it?
No, they
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it would effectively allow, the language for an individual would allow two credits for a joint return, one credit for a single return. So,
not the intent of it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I really doubt if that was her intent. I think her intent was $100 per child, not $100 per taxpayer.
You could make the kids all taxpayers.
That would be another amendment.
Oh, okay.
Well, I tell you what, this is going to Ways and Means anyway. I suppose there's no great rush to get this out. I can talk to Representative Close and bring this back next week and do it. So whatever goes out at least is according to her intent. I'd be happy to do that.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I'd prefer that. I think otherwise we may really have her intent distorted here.
Sure. I don't want her to find out that we did something that she didn't intend, even if that's what she asked us to do. So, on that, let me close the work session on House Bill 2477 and see how we do on House Bill 3080. I'll open that. Ed?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, House Bill 3080, as you will recall, exempts from income tax the earnings on qualified withdrawals from Oregon Tuition Savings Plan accounts beginning of the 2002 tax year. We did have a public hearing on this bill on March 20th, however, no work session.
And I requested the dash twos.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. You requested the dash twos, which moved the effective date from 2002 tax year out to the 2003 tax year. There were also dash one amendments, which were distributed in the last hearing, which make a technical correction to the language of the bill to conform with the federal treatment of earnings on qualified tuition savings plans.
Committee, I requested the dash twos because under the bill as originally proposed, it's a modest $46,000 fiscal impact this session, going up to $250,000 in the next biennium after that. So not a huge fiscal impact, but my concern was that in this session, even a $46,000 impact could attract attention, and I frankly didn't want to do that. Most of these plans are for long-term investment. I don't think that we have many taxpayers investing in these plans, counting on taking withdrawals out in the next couple of years anyway. So my thought was to get this in, mitigate the fiscal impact now, and again, it will start at 46. I assume the fiscal impact would just move that out, the numbers you gave us from last time.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I think that's correct. It would effectively eliminate the revenue impact in the current
year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we're looking at $250,000 in the biennium out after that, in the full biennium. So that would be my intent to go with the dash ones to make the technical correction, and the dash twos to delay the effective date of this to tax year beginning in 2003.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3080.
Thank you. Representative Witt moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3080. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
Move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3080.
Representative Witt moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3080. Is there any discussion? Objection? Ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3080 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves House Bill 3080 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Hayes. Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Powell.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Witt.
Aye.
Ashford
Allison.
Aye.
McCleary.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3080 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll ask Representative Williams to carry that.
That'll be fine, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Then, okay, let's bring up Jim Jensen for House HJM 25. We'll be hearing that, and I want to move right into Representative Witt's House Bill 2704. Yeah. Well, we don't have time for all these people. Tim Jensen is an intern in the Legislative Revenue Office, so we welcome you, I think, for your first appearance today with us this session.
Definitely. House Joint Memorial 25 basically requests that the Congress of the United States eliminate the marriage tax penalty by equalizing treatment between married and single taxpayers. I think with handouts, you have some information that I've written down about the marriage penalty tax. And to describe it, the marriage penalty basically exists when the sum of tax liability for two unmarried individuals filing separate returns is less than the sum of their tax liability if they were to marry and file a joint return. Right now, under the current federal tax structure, roughly 21 million married couples are subject to the marriage penalty tax. Looking at having equal treatment of all taxpayers, you have to start out by looking at basic standard deductions for federal taxes. And equal treatment between married and single taxpayers will be reached when the deduction for married taxpayers filing jointly is twice as large as the standard deduction for single taxpayers. And to give you some numbers, for 2,000 federal taxes, the basic standard deduction for single taxpayers was $4,550, and the basic standard deduction for married couples was $7,600. An equal tax structure would make the basic standard deduction for married taxpayers $9,100, basically two times $4,550. Another place that you need to look at to eliminate the marriage tax penalty is with tax brackets, and elimination of the marriage tax penalty will require you to deal with those. And wait a minute. Okay. So in 2000, single individuals making $0 to $26,250 were included in the 15% federal income tax bracket. And for the same tax year, married couples filing joint returns were included in the 15% federal income tax bracket if their income was $0 to $43,850. So to equalize treatment of single and married taxpayers, rate brackets for married couples filing jointly would need to be twice as large as the corresponding rate brackets for single individuals. So under an equal bracket structure, married couples filing joint returns would be included in the 15% federal income tax rate bracket if their income was $0 to $52,500, two times $26,250. I've also looked a little bit at the congressional tax package that's currently being examined by the Senate. And what this tax package did does is replaces current income tax rates of 15, 28, 31, 36, and 39.6% with an income tax rate structure of 10, 15, 25, and 33% for all taxpayers. What this package does is it eliminates the marriage penalty for taxpayers in the lowest income brackets. So under the congressional plan, the 10% tax rate bracket would be people making $0 to $6,000 for single individuals. At the same time, you'd have married couples falling into, or married couples filing joint returns falling into this tax bracket if their income was $0 to $12,000. So since the tax bracket for married individuals is twice as large as it is for single returns, this does represent equal treatment of all taxpayers. What the package does not do is eliminate the marriage penalty for taxpayers in income brackets above 10%. So, for example, the 15% tax break bracket does not equalize treatment between single and married taxpayers, because in this bracket you have people included for, you have single people filing single returns, 6,000, 27,000, 50, and the corresponding bracket for married couples filing jointly is 12,000 to 45,200. So to equalize treatment of all taxpayers, the upper limit on this 15% bracket for married individuals would need to be 54,100, basically two times 27,050. Another issue that the congressional tax package covers is deductions, and it has a deduction for two earner families. It allows a lower earning spouse to deduct 10% of the first $30,000 of his or her income. So this amounts to basically a maximum deduction of $3,000. This was included, I think, because it's tied to the fact that married couples with earnings split evenly between both spouses generally pay a high marriage penalty tax. So this higher deduction for married couples would reduce the marriage penalty. But to truly equalize treatment between single and married taxpayers, standard deductions will need to be restructured so that the basic standard deduction for a married couple filing jointly will need to be twice as large as the basic standard deduction for a single taxpayer. So looking at the congressional tax package altogether, nowhere in there, I think, will you find that it's going to be a complete elimination of the marriage penalty tax. It reduces it. It does not get rid of it entirely. And obviously, right now, it's under consideration by the Senate. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much. Questions? We don't have any witnesses signed up, so we're it. I see we have two co-sponsors of this memorial on the committee, Representative Brown and Representative Witt, but the first with his hand in the air is Representative Hass. I know. You want to ask something about Portland married couples?
We're going to do minority report.
I am a freshman, and some of you senior members may have more patience in this, but I have to tell you that I've just about had it with these memorials.
Really?
I mean, I think it's a waste of time here discussing federal policies, and a more appropriate response, as far as I'm concerned, on this issue is what we can do as a state, and that's House Bill 2704. I think that's a better use of our time, more productive, and I just am already growing weary of doing these meaningless memorials.
I would, Mr. Chair, if I can,
yeah,
recommend to Representative Hass that he draft a memorial in the opposition to memorials.
That would be a memorial.
Yeah.
That would be a memorial. A resolution, a concurrent resolution, perhaps. And, yeah.
I think, actually, what he would need to draft is a memorial to Congress to ignore all the memorials you've already sent.
No. They don't even get a mind of that.
That's right.
They got a big can up there.
That being said, and I appreciate where Representative Hass is going with this, I'm in support of this. I don't think it hurts those in Congress who are trying to eliminate the marriage penalty to get memorials like this from as many states and other interested parties as possible, and try to use it productively to try to eliminate the marriage penalty at the federal level, just like we're working to eliminate the marriage penalty at the state level. And Representative, I think this just kind of goes with the territory here. You know, members introduce these things, and I think you try to give them consideration and try to deal with them efficiently. We didn't do very well yesterday, though, I should add, on the floor, as far as the efficiency part of this is concerned.
Well, I'll tell you my thinking in scheduling this, and frankly, I my bias is more toward Representative Hass's when it comes to memorials. My thinking, though, is that this happens to correspond so well with the subject matter of House Bill 2704 that I thought it might be worthwhile to discuss this, certainly in the committee, and then perhaps if the committee is inclined to pass this out to the floor at the same time as 2704, so that we sort of we have the talk the talk and walk the walk kind of day where we tell Congress we want them to do it, and at the same time, on the same day, take action to do it ourselves. So that might be an effective way to underscore the memorial more than just passing a memorial that sends a message by U.S. postage service. But that was my thinking. I just thought it might be a nice way to marry these two measures.
I can't have to go there.
Yeah.
Well, if you can assure us there won't be a two-hour debate on the forum we have this, okay.
Portland out of it.
We'll exempt Portland from the marriage penalty, and that will probably make everybody happy. And maybe our married representatives in Washington, D.C. should make be understood that we are exempting them from taxes in the state by getting rid of the state penalty. I'd like to thank this young man for coming and doing this, and an issue that we all made fun of afterwards. I'm sorry. I know you did a lot of serious work on it. And frankly, I was kind of interested in exactly how the marriage penalty works.
Yeah, it's
a position. And so you did a good job. I thank you for it. Is your mom know where you're at right now? I'm just jealous because you got hair and I don't.
No, I do appreciate that. In fact, it's very interesting. We talk about the marriage penalty, but frankly, I've not seen it laid out with the dollar, the bracket amount.
Good job.
Dollars. Here so that I have a better sense exactly what the beast is that we're talking about when we talk about marriage penalty. We know what it is in effect, but not this gets at what is the cause, basically, of the marriage penalty. Okay, anything else on this? My inclination is not to go to work session on this today because I think Ed is going to tell us we need a little bit more work on House Bill 2704, and if we want these two to hit the floor together, we want to make sure we move them out at the same time. So let me then thank you again, Jim, very much for coming up. We'll have you back for the work session, but we'll close the public hearing on HJM 25, and so that Ed can bring us up to date on what our choices are to proceed with 2704, I will open a work session on that, I think, for the last thing on the agenda today.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2704 adjusts or eliminates what we have by way of marriage penalty in Oregon by equalizing the standard deduction amounts for single and joint filers, become effective the 2002 tax year. As we learned last time when we considered this bill, the elimination scenario proposed in the base bill has a revenue impact in the 0103 biennium of approximately $900,000. I was asked to run some additional scenarios adjusting the standard deduction amount, but keeping the double, the joint deduction exactly double the single amount in order to achieve something like revenue neutrality. You can see that adjusting it in $5 increments allows us to bracket the point of revenue neutrality, but not quite hit it. And I don't think we can hit it short of getting down to quarters and nickels and dimes. But what the sheet shows is that if the single deduction amount is set at $1,645, thereby the joint would be $3,290, it would reduce revenues by about $300,000 in the current biennium. However, if we set the bracket, set the deductions at $1,640 for single filer and $3,280 for joint filer, it raises about $300,000.
Representative Witt, how do you feel about that?
Well, I'll tell you, Mr. Chairman, these are kind of moving targets anyhow.
Yeah, they are.
They're estimates anyhow, and I'm comfortable with the $1,640, $3,280. You know, the purpose of this was not necessarily to cut taxes or raise revenue. Obviously, it was just to try to eliminate what I thought was an inequity here.
Well, I would suggest on an $11 billion plus budget, $279 is...
It doesn't bother me.
Revenue neutral.
Yeah, that doesn't, that really is pretty much revenue neutral. So, I mean, I have no problem with the 1640, 3280.
The other thing, Representative Witt, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, is that these amounts are indexed to inflation beginning the 2003 tax year. And the adjustment amount is set at $5 increments. So I can have language drafted in a formal amendment, which would incorporate any changes that the committee wanted to adopt.
What's the committee's pleasure? We've heard from Representative Witt, one of the two sponsors of the bill, that he would support the amounts shown at 1640 for single and 3280 for joint. Does that cause any heartburn among committee members? Okay.
Okay.
Let's go ahead and get those amendments then, and let's reschedule HJM 25 at the same time. Representative Witt.
The only other point, Ed, is the indexing currently in the bill, or do we need to add that?
Representative Witt, members of the committee, that would need to be added. So I need to talk with Dexter about the correct language for that.
Is that reflected here in your projection, revenue projection?
Yes, it is.
It is. So, Mr. Chairman, I would anticipate then that we would be looking at the 1640, 3280 and the index.
Indexing, yeah. Thank you. I meant to say that.
One quick question.
Yes.
Is there any bracketing problems on this, as there is in the federal law? I mean, our law parallels the law of the federal law.
How do you mean?
Part of the federal law problem with bracketing was not just the fact there's a deductible problem with bracketing, because there's no bracketing problem in the federal law.
Oh, I see. No, well, let me see. I mean, moving between brackets, you mean?
Yeah.
Deborah?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. The bracket amounts for married filing joint are exactly double those for a single person. So when you reach the 9% threshold for a married joint, that number is exactly double the 9%.
So they'll move with the standard deduction, I guess.
Well,
no,
they're a separate issue.
Yeah, that's right. They are.
But there won't be the same inequity continuing in state taxes. There isn't. I mean, the federal taxes, if you just change the deductibility, it wouldn't. You'd still have an inequity because of the brackets were different.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, that inequity is not in the Oregon system.
No, I want to know. Thank you.
Representative Kefouri.
So I can ask a question to see if I understand this right. So we are going to raise taxes for single people to pay for this perceived marriage penalty?
Representative Witt.
Representative, yes, to the extent that we are decreasing their standard deduction. And then we're raising the standard deduction for the married couple, and we're trying to do it in a way so that one is exactly twice what the single person is, and at the same time we're trying to be as revenue neutral as we can. But yes, the answer is yes, is we're going from $1,800 to $1,640, which would be, it's not a $160 tax increase, it's a $160 deduction, which would lead presumably to a maximum of about another $14 or $15 in taxes per year. It's relatively minimal.
It's a fairness issue.
It's fair.
It's a fairness issue. Yes, it is.
Well, I would just, Mr. Chairman, I just point out that right now, if you have a couple living together and they're filing separate returns and they use the standard deduction, they get $3,600 in standard deduction under Oregon law. The day they get married and they file a joint return, they get $3,000 in standard deduction. They just lost $600 in their standard deduction just from the fact of getting married. And that's what prompted this bill.
Mr. Chair, and I can appreciate that. I would just propose that if we're going to give relief to this inequity, we should be not raising the taxes for single people, but lowering or raising the deduction then for the joint as opposed to lowering the deduction for a single person.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kefouri, we've been there and
really
looked at the cost of that, and it was several million dollars. And, you know, I think most people on this committee and generally here in the building that we don't want to, in a tight budgetary time, have that kind of impact on our revenues. So the only solution we had was to find some way to equalize these on a revenue-neutral basis. That's why we have this amendment.
It's amazing the impact that can have on behavior. I mean, we just started talking about this, and Representative Beck got engaged.
Yeah, really?
Well, Mr. Chairman, interestingly, this is not necessarily creating an incentive, of course, for marriage. What it's doing is taking away the penalty for getting married. So it's not trying to necessarily form behavior. It's trying to bring neutrality to that decision. And some people on the committee wanted to maybe even go further, but I think at this point, what we're trying to do is not penalize people when they get married.
All right, well, let's get the amendment drafted. We can have the full debate with the amendment back in front of us. Representative Benton?
Am I saying this right? We have a Democrat...
I am trying to figure that out myself.
About... it's something that's backwards. I can't quite put together.
Trying to figure that out myself. That's why I don't want to go to work session. I've got to clear my head.
I guess I've been single. It's not been so long since I've been a single person not making a lot of money, so I understand raising taxes. You folks have been married for many, many years.
We know what costs.
May not understand.
Wait till you have a second kid and have to pay for that kid. You folks are entirely different about all this.
Everyone.
We've got a bunch of tax cranks on this committee. Okay.
I just want to point out to Representative Kefouri, my 20-year-old son, who's thankfully is over in Europe right now, when he finds out about this, won't be too happy with me. And I am concerned about his interests, but I'm also interested in policy that makes sense and in spirit of everybody.
You may want to point out to your son who's in there and my daughter who's there what it costs to put them there, too.
Okay. I think we'd better close that hearing, work session. And adjourn. Everybody have a good weekend. Oh, yeah. Monday.
Monday.
Are you joining us in Commerce this evening?
Dinner will be served at 7:30.
We have to do dinner at 7:30.
Monday. Reminder, this looks like an announcement for the Easter sunrise service, but it's not. It is a reminder for the Monday meeting at 2 o'clock at the Metro Center in Portland. And I, Representative Hass has reminded me to caution all of you to bring bottled water. The meeting's in Portland.
Rains.
Mr. Chairman, what? You know, we have a little conflict.
Yes,
I've got,
you do, and I appreciate
it. How many
that.
Members here?
Three.
Three of
yeah,
us.
Three men.
Is that it?
Four of us. Well,
it is. We're all on work session today. Yeah.
Fine. It's a joint meeting with the Senate. You go on about your business. We'll
tell you all about it.
Bring you up to date when they come back. When they come back, all the bills we'll be hearing. The bills that we'll be hearing up there in Portland. We will come back and have further hearings and work session on here in the building. So.
And Mr. Chair, I won't be able to join you, but have a great time in my district.
Mr. Chairman, maybe what you can do when you're done in Portland on your way home, you can stop at the Capitol. We'll be in Commerce. It should be about 7:30, right? You can update us on how the meeting went.
Would you mind stopping at Pizza Hut?
All right. We are adjourned.